Romans 8 verse 37 says that Christians are more than conquerors. And we are. We are truly more than conquerors. You can, as a conqueror, take all kinds of land in this life. You can have all kinds of people under your control. Christians have something much better than that. We are kings and priests in the kingdom of our God and of our Savior. That is a blessing unlike any other. We are more than conquerors because whatever this world throws at us, it doesn't matter. Even if it kills us, we have victory and reward in the end. That is something I hope that we look at and we take advantage of, because I'm afraid we fail to remember it a lot of times. The world will throw stuff at you, but don't forget whose you are. And because of Him, because of what that sacrifice was that we just partook of, we can be conquerors. Now, on another thought, whenever I think of the word conqueror in the Bible, I think of my man, Joshua, the son of Nun, of the tribe of Ephraim. You know, those of you who know me know this is one of my favorite people in the Bible. Love him dearly for a lot of reasons. He's the man God would choose to lead the Israelites after Moses died. Joshua was a military leader before that. The first time we see him is in Exodus 17. He's going to lead Israel against the Amalekites. And if you remember, the Amalekites had basically cheap-shotted Israel as they were coming out of Egypt. And Joshua was the man chosen to lead them in that battle against them. He was an incredible man of faith. He's a good example for Israel of what faith could accomplish. He's a good example for us today of what faith can accomplish. One of the things that I like about him is he started to serve the Lord early, and he never wavered. I think we can point out one bad spot on his resume, and we'll look at that in Joshua chapter 9 with the Gibeonites. But other than that, this guy was an incredible man of faith. Do you remember, and I don't think about this often, Joshua started his life as a slave. I don't think about that. Where did he begin his life? In Egypt. As a Hebrew slave, along with everybody else except Moses, basically. All the Hebrews were slaves under Pharaoh's control in Egypt. And yet, you see him coming out of that. We see him there, as I mentioned, in Exodus 17 as a military commander. Joshua becomes Moses' assistant later on, and he helps him in all of these various different ways. He becomes one of the 12 spies that Moses chooses to send into the land. And he, along with Caleb, are the only two who give a good report when they come back. Let's actually, if you'll be turning there, Numbers chapter 14, we'll look at a few verses. But one thing about this aspect about him being Moses' assistant, I just want to point out this. Yes, he's a warrior. Yes, he's a great man. But most importantly, he was a servant. And when you think about what Jesus says in Matthew 23:11, "But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant." So here's this great military leader. He's a great general. He's a great fighter. All of these things. He's a servant. And that's what made him useful to God. I need to make sure I understand that. No matter what else I accomplish in this life, if I'm not a servant, then God can't use me like He wants to. Joshua understood this. But let's look and think back to Numbers 14, starting in verse 6. Joshua and Caleb. "But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, 'The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.'" What a great section. And when you think about that, what did Joshua and Caleb see differently from the other spies? Nothing. They saw the exact same thing that the other 10 spies saw. They saw the same giants. They saw the same fortresses. They saw everything the same. But they also saw God's power, which is what the 10 spies failed to see. They saw the giants. They saw the big castles. And they said, "Oh no, we can't handle it." Well, Joshua saw it too. And Caleb saw the giants too. But they saw God's power. And that's what set them apart. That's why they give this speech and say, "Please don't rebel. Don't do this. If God delights in us, He will help us, and we will take this land." Certainly, moments like that define him. And it's no surprise, when Moses' life is drawing to a close, Moses, another man I love dearly, love studying about him. Turn to Numbers 27. Moses is dying, and what's on his mind is the children of Israel. He speaks to God and says, Lord, don't leave them as sheep without a shepherd. Give them somebody who can be the leader they need and lead them into this great land that you've given to them. So here he is, the end of his life, and he's thinking about other people. That's the way Moses always was. Chapter 27 of Numbers, if you look at verse 16. Let the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them and lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. Drop down to verse 22. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. And he laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. So God chose Joshua to be the man who would take Moses' place as the leader of Israel. You talk about some big shoes to fill. You get to be the next Moses. Congratulations. That's what you have to step into, that role. Turn to Joshua 1 and mark your places there in Joshua. We'll plan on being here for the rest of the time. I want us to read the first 9 verses of this chapter and consider what is going on. And as we read this, and God's going to say it, but just consider this the whole time as we go through it. Moses is dead. Moses has led these people for a long, long time. He has been their rock. He has been the example of what man's faith should be like. Did he make some mistakes? He did. But he's a good man, and now he's gone. So with that in mind, God is speaking to Joshua, the new leader of the people. And this is what he says. Verse 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord. How would you like that to be on your tombstone? Servant of the Lord. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread, I have given to you, just as I said to Moses. From the wilderness and from Lebanon as far as the great river, this river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. What an introduction. What a speech. What a conversation that God is having with His new leader of the people. And what does He say to him over and over again? And we'll talk about it some more. You be strong. You be of good courage. I'm with you. Just as I was with Moses, my servant, so I will be with Joshua, my servant. Moses is dead. Joshua knows this. They have mourned him in the plains of Moab for 30 days. Everybody knows that Moses is dead. Up until this point, Joshua's been a great assistant. He has. You go through and look. He was with Moses. And when all that business was going on with the golden calf, by the way, Joshua wasn't there with him. He was at the foot of the mountain waiting on Moses. So even when that stuff's going on, Joshua's shown himself to be diligent throughout all this and a good example. Now it's time to step up. Moses ain't around anymore. And this is what my friend John Gibson calls this, the Moses is dead moment. All of us in our lives have a Moses is dead moment. It may be an elder passes away. It may be a preacher that we respect very much passes away. It may be a mother who has shouldered the burden for all of these years and now she's gone. What are you going to do? Moses is dead. You can't leave the work undone. Somebody's got to step up and do the work and shoulder the burden. Maybe nobody died. Maybe I've just grown to the point in my life where now it's time for me to pick up and do some things, to shoulder some of the burden. Moses is dead. What am I going to do? It's a question Joshua has to ask. Even when Joshua made those great statements of faith we read about in Numbers 14, remember verses 6 through 9? We can do this, God's with us. Even then, even if the people had agreed, Moses was still the one who would take them in. He would have taken them in. Moses was still the leader. So even when Joshua made that statement of faith, he wasn't the guy. He was the assistant. Now it's on him. What will he do? Be strong and of good courage. Why does God say this three times in the first nine verses? Why does God say this? Because faith and courage will disappear if they're not nurtured. Imagine, you know, when you look at this, you might think God's talking to a timid man. When you read this, you might think, you know what, is Joshua just this real quiet and so meek that he doesn't know how to fight? That's not who Joshua is. He knows how to fight. Not only had they defeated the Amalekites, they have fought and defeated Og, king of Bashan. They have fought and defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites. Does Joshua know how to fight? Sure he does. So why is God telling this man these things? Because our faith needs to constantly be fed, or it will grow weaker. It will fade over time. It's either going to grow or it's going to fade. It's never going to stay the same. God understands that. Our faith can fail us and our strength can wane. We studied about this Friday night a week ago in our Bible class. We looked at Elijah. Elijah, at the height of his strength, after confronting the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, he is just glowing with faith and strength and power. And then what do you read right after that? He is running for his life from Jezebel. See, that's what can happen if it's not constantly nurtured and constantly being built up. So, how do we do that? How do we nurture our faith? Faith comes by hearing. Hearing by the Word of God. Romans 10:17. We do it by studying God's Word and being strengthened by that. We can go to Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 25, where it is stressed the importance of the assembling of ourselves together. We are to come together because together we build each other up and we nurture each other's faith. Think of the Christians who have stirred you up to be better. Have any Christians ever stirred you up to be better? Sure they have. They've built us up. They've nurtured our faith over the years. You remember when you first became a Christian? Those of us who are very fortunate, who are in good situations, I think many of us were surrounded by Christians who just really took to us and they tried to help us along those first months and years. They tried to study with us. They tried to give us opportunities to do things. I appreciate that because they were nurturing my faith and building me up that whole time. That's what God is doing for Joshua here. Verse 5 is the key. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. It's not about Joshua, really. The strength comes from God. And the promise is, Joshua, I'm not going to leave you. Could Joshua have left him? Yeah, but God's not leaving him. That's the thing. Verse 9, along with it, the Lord is with His people when they walk with Him. He has always promised that. If God is for us, who can be against us? We see that in Romans 8:31. Now, turn to Joshua chapter 5. I want to see some things. We're going to go through and look at some major events in the life of Joshua during the conquest and afterwards. We sing a song called Trust and Obey. And as we look at the next, three points, just keep it in mind. Trust and Obey. It's a song you can sing, but do we live it? Joshua lived it. Chapter 5. The children of Israel have just crossed over the Jordan River. So they've crossed over into Canaan. Now, it was miraculous because, I mean, they didn't build a bridge and they didn't build rafts and they didn't try to find a ford. The Jordan not only was full, it was flooded at this time of year. And God miraculously causes the waters of the Jordan to back up and stand in a heap far away so that the children of Israel can pass over on dry land. It happens as soon as the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant on their shoulder, as soon as their heels touch the water of the flooded Jordan, don't miss that point. the water recedes. And it's not mud that they're walking on across. They're walking across dry land. And they carry the Ark of the Covenant from the eastern side of the Jordan. The eastern side of the Jordan over to the western side, which is Canaan proper. That's the land that they've been promised. And they get over into that land. It is a glorious moment, because don't miss the comparison. Moses led them on dry ground through the Red Sea. Who's leading them on dry ground over the Jordan now? Their new leader, Joshua. But who's doing it? The same one who did it at the Red Sea. God is with Joshua just as he was with Moses. They should have gotten that picture and figured it out. Glorious moment, miraculous, it's fantastic in all these ways. But notice what God does as soon as they get over into Canaan. Canaan is dangerous, by the way. There are a lot of people who live there who want to kill these Israelites because these Israelites are trying to take their land. They don't like that. Notice what God requires of Joshua first. Chapter 5, verse 2. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time." I am not going to go into a detailed description of circumcision and what it involves. Needless to say, it would put these men at a very big disadvantage physically. It would have been excruciatingly painful. And if you remember Genesis 34, remember that whole Dinah incident when Simeon and Levi convinced the men of the city to be circumcised, and then they come in and kill them all because the men are in such pain they can't defend themselves? There's circumcision. Okay? Now why, you may say, "Lance, why are you bringing this up?" Think about where they are. He could have asked Joshua to circumcise them on the east side of the Jordan, right? They had already conquered everybody on the eastern side. That land was for what? Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. It was safe on the east side. He waits until they get right in the middle of the enemy, and then he says, "Now I want you to circumcise them." What does Joshua do, by the way? Verse 3. So Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. He does exactly what God says. My question here is, why? Why here? Why now? What is God doing? What is God doing? He is forcing them to rely on Him. See, it's not about Israel's numbers. And it's not about Israel's strength. It's not about Israel at all. He is forcing them to trust Him and say, "Lord, we are absolutely helpless against this enemy that is encompassed around us. We must trust You." Right? They're surrounded. Where are you going to go? Jordan came back down, by the way. They must trust God. And that's what He's showing them. Joshua does it, just as he's commanded. And after time, they were healed. No enemies came against them. God protected them during this time. He is teaching them a lesson. True faith does not look around and do a risk assessment. Do you know what I mean by that? True faith doesn't look around and say, "Well, I don't know if this is the right time. Maybe we should wait. Why don't we try it in about a week? It'll be a better situation in like a week." True faith doesn't look around and do a risk assessment. True faith does what God tells it to do right then. And that is what He's expecting of them. You know, could doing the right thing cost me? Could it cause me trouble in this life? Standing for truth? Doing the right thing? Yeah. There have been preachers who preached a lesson and were looking for a new group to work with the next day because it didn't go well, even though they taught truth. It could cost us something in this life, but for me or any man who stands up here, before you preach, which question do you ask? Do you ask, "Well, I wonder how they're going to respond to this one?" Or do you ask, "What has the Lord said about this?" Because depending on those questions, one of them trusts the Lord and one of them doesn't. And if I'm asking that first question, "I wonder how they're going to respond," I'm putting myself in a bad situation. Eventually, I'll start watering down what I teach. God demanded them to trust Him. I'm going to steal another saying from John Gibson. I guess it's the morning for it. When God expects us to do it, God expects us to do it. Right? Some of that brilliant State of Alabama logic going around. But isn't it true? When God expects us to do it, God expects us to do it. That's what he expected of them. It's what he expected of Joshua. And Joshua, man that he was, did it just as the Lord commanded. Turn to chapter 6. As we're thinking, just think about this. When God tells us to do something, he may not allow us the comfort of the east side of the Jordan. He may expect us to do it right in the middle of hostile land. But he's with us. If he wants it done, he will be with us. Joshua chapter 6, this is the taking of Jericho. Probably for most people, this is the most memorable part of the book of Joshua. Jericho. People know about the taking of Jericho, even if they don't know much more about Joshua or this book. He has fought in many battles already, but he has never fought in one like this. This is something completely different. Chapter 6, look at verse 2. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go around the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day you will march around the city 7 times, and the priests will blow the trumpets. And it will come to pass when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, when you hear the sound of that trumpet, all the people will shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and all the people shall go up, every man straight before him." He has fought Amalekites, and he has fought Amorites, and he is even Og of Bashan was a giant on top of that. He has never done this. This is not normal thinking. This is not the orthodox way to take a city. Now, if God had said, "What I want you to do is build siege engines. Or what I want you to do is I want you to build a siege mound. Build a huge mound of dirt and surround the city and starve them. Or tunnel under the walls and get into this." Any of those would have been acceptable practices at the time. This is not normal. This is not how people take a city. Does it kind of remind you of what God told Noah? God asked Noah to do something completely unorthodox that nobody thought made any sense. And what did Noah do? He did what the Lord said. What does Joshua do? Here, to human senses, this does not make sense. Look at verse 7. He said to the people, "Proceed. Proceed. Do as the Lord has commanded." The conquest of Jericho was never about the children of Israel. It was never about their might or their great numbers or their number of swords that they brought with them. It was always about God's plan. That's why the plan seems strange, but this plan puts everything in God's hands because he's going to do what would have been impossible for them to do. All they had to do was what he told them to do. Let's make an application real quick. Sometimes today questions come up like, why do I have to be baptized? What good does the water do? What? How can baptism wash away sins? Doing the impossible is God's part. Let him handle his part. What do I do? What he's told me to do. Taking Jericho by walking around it, blowing on some horns and yelling at it, that is not happening if you and I come up with that plan. But the impossible is God's part. And he took care of it. All they had to do was what he told them. Baptism washing away my sins is impossible to my mind. But God took care of that part. All I have to do is what he told me. It's the same principle that Joshua was operating on here. Turn to Joshua 9. Certainly, by the way, I know you've read it, but the taking of Jericho was successful. They went in and absolutely took that city. Joshua 9, I wanted us to talk about this because this is that one bad spot on Joshua's shining resume. This is when the Gibeonites trick him and the children of Israel. Just some background information. The Gibeonites were Canaanites. Canaanites had 2 choices when Israel came into the land. You either die or you flee. Those are your options. There are no other ones. The Gibeonites knew they had no chance of fighting against Israel. They had seen what had been done. So the Gibeonites said, "You know what we're going to do? We're going to trick them." So they get these old busted up shoes, and they get moldy bread, and they get these torn wineskins that are old, and they come walking up to Israel and say, "We are from a far land, and we want to make peace with you." God had told Israel, if the people are from Canaan, you give them no mercy. You drive them out or you destroy them. remove them from the land. But if there are people from a far land that you come in contact with, you may attempt to make peace with them, and that is acceptable. The Gibeonites lie. They say, "We are from a far land. We heard what you did with Sihon, king of the Amorites. And we heard what you did with Og, king of Bashan." Notice they don't say anything about Jericho or Ai, because that just happened. And if they traveled from a far land, they wouldn't have gotten news of that. These guys are smart. Very, very smart. So they present this to Joshua and the men of Israel. And look at verse 14. This is just the saddest thing. As good a man as Joshua has shown himself to be, this is a huge mistake. Joshua 9, verse 14. "The men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. They looked at their busted up shoes, and they looked at their torn wineskins, and they looked at their moldy, nasty bread, and they said, 'Well, these guys are from a long way away.' But they never asked the Lord counsel." And it gets them in trouble. They're going to end up having to come to the Gibeonites' rescue shortly after this. They're going to be basically burdened with them after this. They'll end up serving the children of Israel. But all of this came about because they didn't seek counsel of the Lord. The point I want us to see from this is you and I need to be people of this book. When we have questions and concerns, we need to go to this book and see what it has said. We need to seek counsel of the Lord. Do you demand authority for everything you do in the name of the Lord? We should. We must. And here, as good a man as Joshua is, when he doesn't, it gets him into trouble. If we're constantly checking this book, we won't get fooled. When people bring false doctrine in, we won't be fooled. And when people start trying to get us to do things that we have no authority to do, we won't be fooled, because we're people of the book. Well, let's look at some final thoughts. Turn to the end of the book, Joshua 23 and 24. The conquest of Canaan has been successful. Joshua has led them to victory. The land has been divided among the tribes, and it is now their individual responsibility to drive out the remaining Canaanites from their tribal lands. That's on them now. Time has passed. Joshua 23. Joshua is old. Look at verses 1 and 2. "Came to pass a long time after the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua was old, advanced in age. And Joshua called for all Israel, their elders, their heads, their judges, for their officers, and said to them, 'I am old and advanced in age.'" He's 110, by the way. He's old. He's seen a lot. He's been through a lot. He is about to die. If you look at verse 14, "I'm going the way of all the earth." That means death is near. Notice his final words for Israel. Look at verse 6. "Therefore, be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left." Now, wait a minute. Hadn't I heard that before somewhere? That sounds distinctly familiar to something that somebody once told him. If you go back to Joshua chapter 1, isn't this the same principles that God was telling him at the very beginning? Guess who believed it? And he is now passing that on to someone else. He's passing it on to another generation and reminding them, don't depart from God's law. Don't turn to the right hand or to the left. Do what he's commanded of you. He is old, but look at verse 10. "One man of you shall chase 1,000, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he promised you. Therefore, take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God, or else if indeed you do go back, and you cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and you make marriages with them, and you go into them, and they into you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they will be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Behold, this day I am going all the way of the earth, and you know in all your hearts and your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass for you, not a word of them has failed." You know what? Sometimes when we get older, we get soft. Sometimes we have stood for faith for a long, long time, and then situations get in and we just kind of get tired of fighting the good fight. not Joshua. He is on fire to the very end. And, you know, sometimes when the great-great-grandparents, they get a little soft on the kids and they just let them get away with all kinds of stuff. Notice what he says. Verses 13, you know for certain, if you do those things God told you not to do, He will bring all of those curses down on you. And those people, if you tolerate them and you go into them and you make alliances with them, they will be like thorns in your eyes. That is about the most painful thing I can imagine. That's what they're going to be like. 110 years old, and the man hadn't lost a spark of his fire. I pray to my Lord I will be that way at the end. Sometimes saints go out with a whimper, and that's a shame. This one went out on fire. That's what I want, and I hope that's what all of us want for ourselves. Turn to chapter 24. This is the last one. He had his priorities straight. Will we stand up for truth, or will we be swallowed up by this world? Those are our only two options. Joshua 24, verse 24. The people said to Joshua, "This Lord our God we will serve, and His voice will obey." So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. Now go back up. I want to look at 14 and 15. Because this is probably the most well-known two verses of Joshua. Notice how he starts and notice how he ends. "Now therefore, fear the Lord, serve Him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served which were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Look at 14 again. Notice how he starts the verse, "Therefore fear the Lord." And notice how he ends the verse, "Serve the Lord." I get those two right, I will get this life right. I will be pleasing to my Lord if I fear Him first and then I serve Him. If those are the bookends of my life, I'll get it right. There will be bumps along the way, and I know that, and there will be failures and stumbles, but I will get it right. Israel, at this time, was probably thinking, and Les mentioned this in the class in the previous hour. Israel's probably thinking, you know, man, this is a good land. And so what happens when you start to get content? They start thinking about politics, you know, because like before too terribly much longer, what are they going to be talking about? You know what, we need a king like everybody else. We need a king. They start thinking about politics, and they start thinking about, this land is so great, let's talk about our farming, and let's talk about our trading. What does Joshua talk about at the end? Righteousness and serving the Lord. Those are the two points, the two principles that everything else hinge upon. I simply bring that up at the end to make this point. It doesn't matter what happens in this nation. It doesn't matter what happens in this state, what laws are made, and what kind of limitations are placed on you and me. And it doesn't even matter what happens in this local church. I can still serve the Lord. I can. Nobody can stop me from serving the Lord except me. This country can come up with laws that make us do things, that try to make us do things that would violate our conscience and violate this word, but they can't make you. This state would come up with things that may seem to force you to have to do things. They can't make you. They can't make you sin. Even if this congregation chose error, they can't make me sin. And it can't make you sin. We can serve the Lord. Nobody can stop us, except for us. The question, of course, is will we? Will we make that dedication? Will we be like Joshua? I hope we want that. Let's look at one more. Joshua 11. And we'll finish with 11 verse 15. I think it's a good one to end on. Joshua chapter 11. Verse 15. Just so appropriate. "As the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses." And make the application. As the Lord commanded the apostles, so the apostles have commanded us. How does that sentence end? Have we left anything undone of what the apostles have commanded us? Or are we like Joshua? Can we say we did everything we were given? Joshua went to his grave knowing that he was pleasing to the Lord. So can I. So can you. We can make sure of that this morning. Get your songbooks out.